This is Tax Update for Saturday, April the 15th, 2006. Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying on the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. This podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, who provide email newsletters and resources of use to tax professionals for a monthly subscription fee. You can visit their website at www.limeburgservices.com. Well, we're here right at the end of tax season, and most likely, I would suspect that you've delayed listening to this until after the 17th deadline, but if you're listening to it before, that's fine. We're going to go ahead and go on the regular schedule this week to get things up and going for the week. And this week, we're going to look at a private letter ruling the IRS came down with in a what is otherwise might be considered a mundane area of the tax law, but one which impacts a lot of clients, especially with real estate prices where they've been and people in and out of houses or leaving homes maybe quickly, more quickly than they had before, simply because they see appreciation and they're trying to cash out. And the question becomes our problem of the Section 121 gain exclusion and the unforeseen circumstances rule. Now, this week the IRS came down with a ruling that was kind of interesting in where it applied the unforeseen circumstance rule to a set of facts that otherwise some professionals might have considered would not qualify. What we'll look at this year is a general unforeseen circumstance rule, as well as the specific ruling, and consider both the implications of what this ruling tells us about what might work that you might have assumed wouldn't, and also how not to overuse this ruling or read more into the ruling than's really there. Now, I don't know about your clients, but mine seem to never forget old tax rules. Every year I get asked about things like income averaging. And until a couple of years ago, every year I'd be asked about deducting sales taxes, and Congress put that back into law. So now your clients, probably like some of mine, believe that I'd been lying to them all these years when now suddenly there are ways to use sales taxes. The other thing clients tend to remember, especially these days, or have to be reminded of, is that no longer can you roll over the proceeds from the sale of your residence and defer any gain that you might incur. If you remember, the old Section 1034 from 1997 and earlier allowed us to basically roll over gains. In 1997, Congress basically replaced that provision by giving us an exclusion that happened once every 2 years, that was available once every 2 years. What they really did was took what was formerly the once-in-a-lifetime exclusion, raised the limit, removed the age requirement, and allowed us to use it more than once every once in a lifetime, said every 2 years we can use this, but this is the exclusive remedy. In 1997, they established the limits, which are $250,000 for a single individual, $500,000 for a married couple, for the exclusion of gain. Now, while people on the coast at the time felt those numbers were way too low, in much of the rest of the country, it was seen as a boon that no one ever saw gains of that size, so there's no problem. Well, times change, and these days, many of us are seeing gains of that size on a more regular basis. As well, many of us are seeing significant gains being incurred by individuals who own their home for less than 2 years. What we are seeing is with real estate prices in some markets that went superheated over the past couple of years, people who have been in a home maybe a year, 18 months, suddenly have a significant gain. These individuals may end up wanting to move out of their house for whatever reason and into another one and sell before the 2 years are up. Now, Congress did allow a break and saying, well, if you don't meet the two-year rules, because under Section 121, we have a number of two-year tests. As mentioned, we can only use the gain once every 2 years. So we can't use the exclusion if we have used that exclusion within the past 2 years. As well, even if we don't have that problem, we still have to have owned the home for 2 years prior to the date of sale, actually 2 years of the 5 years prior to the date of sale. Plus, we have to have used it as our principal residence for 2 years of the 5 years prior to the date of sale. If you fail to meet any of these two-year tests, you can't use a 121 exclusion. Your gain is fully taxable as capital gain. Now, under Old 1034, that wasn't the issue. Essentially, under Old 1034, as long as you basically had used the house as your principal residence, you could continue to roll over the gain. Well, some taxpayers now, of course, remember that and believe they have that fix, and you have to tell them, sorry, that doesn't work. Your gain is going to be taxable unless we can meet the narrow exception found in Section 121C. Now, 121C provides for a proration. You kind of earn the exemption, earn the maximum exemption over time, but only if your sale meets certain criteria. And basically, the criteria are found in Section 121C2B. That gives us three different tests that we can use to qualify for this prorated maximum gain. If the sale or exchange is by reason of a change in place of employment, there's test one, health, test two, or the more interesting one that we're going to talk about today, to the extent provided in regulations, unforeseen circumstances. Now, the IRS promulgated Regulation 1.121-3 in August of 2004 that dealt with this provision. Those of you who may remember the regulations under 121 when they came out on Christmas Eve of 2003 may remember that 3 initially came out as a temporary regulation, with temporary and proposed regulations issued simultaneously. That while all other regulations went final, this was the one that was held open for comment and questions and issues for a longer period of time and didn't go final till the following August. Now, the Regulation 1.21-3 tells us what the IRS believes the first two rules cover, change in place of employment, what is a health-related sale reason. Those definitions are found in that regulation. And remember, these are statutory issues, so we have a statutory basis for if it's change in place of employment, that's a qualified event. If it is due to health, that's a qualified event under the statute. Unforeseen circumstances, due to the way the code was written, basically put this in the hands of the IRS, saying that to the extent provided in regulations, unforeseen circumstances. That clause seems to force us to look at what the IRS has said qualifies as unforeseen circumstances, that because we essentially, Congress said, we're not just going to say unforeseen circumstances and leave that up to the courts. We're going to say we want the IRS to address other unforeseen circumstances that we think will be, should be covered and should be granted this benefit. Now, in Regulation 1.21-3E1, the IRS provides the test and the areas used for this unforeseen circumstances exception. And we find the general rule is that a sale or exchange is by reason of unforeseen circumstances if the primary reason for the sale or exchange is the occurrence of an event that the taxpayer could not reasonably have anticipated before purchasing and occupying the residence. Now that's the inclusion test. In order for our reason to clear the hurdle, we basically have to be able to show the taxpayer could not have. Note it does not say the taxpayer did not. You know, it's not saying the taxpayer, actually didn't anticipate. It's saying they could not have anticipated. So that's a higher standard. In essence, the IRS doesn't have to show, or you just can't have the taxpayer say, well, I never thought of this. That's tough luck. The taxpayer could not have reasonably anticipated before purchasing and occupying the residence. Now, that's the other key thing. The event, the anticipation of the event, you take a look at when did you purchase and occupy. There are two tests there. Remember, we have ownership, we have use. So basically, if you could have reasonably anticipated the problem before either purchasing or before occupation moving in to the residence, then you don't have an unforeseen circumstance. Now, the IRS goes on and gives us a couple of exclusions. They say a sale or exchange by reason of unforeseen circumstances other than a sale or exchange deemed to be by reason of unforeseen circumstances under paragraph E2 or 3 of this section, does not qualify for the reduced maximum exclusion if the primary reason for the sale or exchange is a preference for a different residence or an improvement in financial circumstances. Now, those are both exclusion tests. In essence, you're not going to be able to make it if the primary reason for your sale is you prefer a different residence. You're also not going to make it if the primary reason for your sale is because your circumstances have improved financially, and that improvement is what's causing you to say, well, I'm going to go out and get a new residence. Now, the IRS goes on under this regulation to address specific safe harbors that will qualify. These safe harbors are, by definition, unforeseen circumstances. So, essentially, we can take them and add them to the statutory employment and health list. And these are include the involuntary conversion of the residence. So if you have an involuntary conversion, that qualifies as an unforeseen circumstance by definition. Number two, natural or man-made disasters or acts of war or terrorism resulting in a casualty to the residence. Notice the dual test here. You have the disaster and you have the resulting casualty without regard to deductibility under Section 165H. So that says we don't have to meet the test for a deductible casualty under 165H. We merely have to have a casualty occur to the residents via a natural or man-made disaster, an act of war, or terrorism. Number three, we have a set of tests that involve what are called qualified individuals. Now, this is a term that is used in these regulations in a couple of cases. We get the narrower definition for this particular purpose. In the narrower definition, qualified individuals are the following individuals: the taxpayer's spouse, a co-owner of the residence, and a person whose principal place of abode is in the same household as the taxpayer. So anyone that meets one of those four categories, if these events occur involving that individual, you have an unforeseen circumstance by definition. What are these tests? In this case, we have five things that could happen. A, death. Okay, pretty obvious. That one probably wouldn't surprise you, that basically if the taxpayer dies, well, if the taxpayer dies, we don't really have an owner, and 121 kind of goes out of the equation until we get to the repeal of the estate tax and all of and those issues where we finally get sort of a carryover into the estate. But basically, that one's kind of, well, okay. But the taxpayer's spouse, the co-owner of the residence, so if I own the residence with somebody else, that somebody else dies, I can sell my share now and exclude my gain due to the unforeseen circumstance. Or a person whose principal place of abode is in the same household as the taxpayer. So that means anyone who lives, who used that as a residence, who dies, that individual, that will qualify the owner of the residence to go ahead and exclude the gain as an unforeseen circumstance, even if they don't meet the two-year test. Number two test, cessation of employment, as a result of which the qualified individual is eligible for unemployment compensation as defined in Section 85B. Again, same group of individuals, they lose employment, and they qualify for unemployment compensation. So you have a dual test there. You basically need to have somebody who's qualified for unemployment compensation. Test number three for that group, a change in employment or self-employment status that results in the taxpayer's inability to pay housing costs and reasonable basic living expenses for the taxpayer's household, including amounts for food, clothing, medical expenses, taxes, transportations, court-ordered payments, and expenses reasonably necessary to the production of income, but not for the maintenance of an affluent or luxurious standard of living. How's that for a not clear test? Nevertheless, what they're generally saying is if your economic condition moves downward, and it moves downward so that you can't afford basic living expenses and this house, you can sell the house, exclude the gain, at least the prorated, remember, portion of the gain. We don't get the automatic $250,500 if we've lived there only 1 year, we get half of those limits, but we can still exclude that much of the gain. Number four, divorce or legal separation under decree of divorce or separate maintenance. Again, divorce, legal separation under a decree of divorce. So we need to legally, we can't just say essentially, you know, well, we're planning on it. If there has to be basically a divorce, a decree of divorce or separate maintenance in place. Number five, multiple births resulting from the same pregnancy. Now, some commentators have kind of been interested in that last two, because sometimes they seem to imply that, well, divorce is an unforeseen circumstance, marriage is not, and apparently a birth resulting in a single child is a foreseeable circumstance, multiple births from the same pregnancy are not. So essentially, it seems like, you know, they're saying, does that mean you could never get either of those cases? I would say that's not a never, but what the IRS is saying is they're not going to give those automatic coverage as unforeseen circumstances. Their theory is that it seems to them that it very likely might have been reasonably possible for you to foresee that you would marry someone within the 2 years. You know, presuming at the time you were in a position where it appeared that there would be, you know, a wedding was on the horizon. And then at that time you go, oh, we got married and now we're moving in together. And, oh, well, we need a bigger place. That's not going to necessarily be an unforeseen circumstance in the IRS's view. Arguably, if in fact you might view it this way, if in fact, though, you were not aware of that at that point, the situation arose later, but before the 2 years are up, you make that decision, then you may have one under these rules. Again, remember, the test here is these provide for the automatic inclusion as well, multiple births from the same pregnancy. The IRS is saying, well, you know, having twins or triplets may be a surprise, and it's certainly difficult to plan on having twins or triplets. But they're saying it's very possible that it's reasonably foreseeable that people will have children. It does happen regularly. And that because of that, that we're not going to just allow you by saying, oh, we had a child, and use that as the reason to get into the 2 year period. If in fact it was clear you had been planning to have that child all along, you know, basically it was something that you were totally, you know, expecting to have happen, something you expect to happen during that time period. Now you have the child and you view the child maybe perhaps in today's real estate market as a get out of jail free card. I can sell my house. I can cash in the gain. It would be great. And the answer is, well, no, you can't do that. Necessarily, you're going to have to show that it was an unforeseen circumstance. In essence, you don't get the automatic inclusion. As well, let us remember the IRS reserved under E3 the right to designate other events as unforeseen circumstances. That provision said the commissioner may designate other events or situations as unforeseen circumstance and publish guidance of general applicability, and may issue rulings addressed to specific taxpayers identifying other events or situations as unforeseen circumstances with regard to those taxpayers. Now, that's a two-pronged test. The first half of that test, where the IRS may issue notices, in essence, they don't have to issue a regulation. That helps cover a situation that actually came out prior to these regulations. The IRS issued unforeseen circumstance guidance or allowances for individuals impacted by the September 11th terrorist attacks. The IRS allowed in certain situations individuals to treat those as unforeseen circumstances for purposes of this test, even though at the time there were no regulations in place. And if you read the law literally, in the absence of regulations, there didn't seem to be a way to get an unforeseen circumstance, since unforeseen circumstance had to be defined by regulation. But what the IRS has said in the regulation now has enabled them to go back, and if something occurs, if some situation arises, they can issue something like the notice they did, and that will count for taxpayers to rely upon for unforeseen circumstances. As well, the second half of this opens up the option for taxpayers to get their own rulings, that their situation is an unforeseen circumstance. So you can ask the IRS to rule. Now note, as the regulation points out, This basically is limited to those specific taxpayers. As is normal with a private letter ruling, if I ask for a ruling, it's binding on me. The service has to take that position with regard to me now that they've issued the ruling, but they don't have to take that position with regard to my neighbor who's similarly situated. That may help us understand how the IRS would react if the neighbor asked the same question, but the IRS is not bound to that. So, given that background, it's kind of interesting to look at the examples where the IRS tells us what does and does not qualify. Now, first case, example 5 listed under this section tells us an individual bought a house near a highly traveled road. Now, after a short period of time, the individual moves in, realizes he really can't stand the traffic, and he sells the residence. The safe harbors don't apply, and the IRS holds this was not an unforeseen circumstance because he could have reasonably have foreseen that there would be traffic on that road and that that traffic would create noise, etc., and that's what caused him to sell. Now, let's note, you can read into this by reading between the lines, that it would appear the taxpayer would not have bought the house had he really realized he couldn't stand that level of noise. But the IRS did not allow you to kind of change your mind later or say, well, I didn't realize how bad the noise would be, or I didn't realize that I couldn't take the noise. The IRS position was that that's something you should have foreseen, and therefore you should have acted and done some work ahead of time, and we're not going to let you get out by selling that house. Now, the IRS also has a set of examples, in examples 7, 8, and 10, that show us that if you just get a better financial circumstance, that's also not going to qualify. In example 7, an individual buys a small condominium. Before the 2 years are up, this individual receives a promotion and a large increase in salary, so she can sell the small condominium, and she can then go and purchase a large house. Well, the fact that her financial situation improved is fatal to the unforeseen circumstance exception. Whether or not she reasonably could have known her situation would improve, that's not going to qualify her for relief under 121. Basically, you got to stick out the 2 years if your reason for selling is because your circumstances have improved. Now, in example 8, we have, now that's kind of the, you know, my circumstances improved due to I now have more income. In example 8, an individual buys a house that he uses as his principal residence. He sells the house basically a little over a year later because the house is greatly appreciated in value. Mortgage rates have decreased, and he can now afford a larger house. The IRS again rules that's an improvement in financial situation. That's not going to qualify. So basically, even though it wasn't that his income improved, it wasn't that he's, you know, on paper, he has the same income, we will presume, coming in. Everything looks the same. The fact that he could qualify for a nicer house now because of external financial situations or external economic situations does not qualify him for the exception. And example 10, individual buys a small house to use as a residence, then the individual hits and wins the lottery. Sells a house, buy a bigger house. As you might expect, the IRS rules that's a change in economic circumstance for the better. We're not going to give you the exception. Now, one interesting example where the IRS allowed it may allow us to understand the private letter ruling we're going to discuss. And this was a case of an individual who worked as a police officer for a city. He buys a condominium that he uses as principal residence. Basically, shortly thereafter, he's assigned to the canine unit and is required to care for the police service dog at his home, but his condominium association rules prohibit individuals who own condominiums in that complex from keeping dogs. Therefore, he has to sell that condominium and move somewhere else. The IRS allowed in that case that was an unforeseen circumstance. That even though he worked for the police department, and even though he had a homeowner association rules that said you could not keep a dog, it was not obvious to him or did not seem foreseeable to him at the time that his work at the police department was going to force him to keep a dog, and that forcing to keep a dog was going to cause a conflict with the rules that would cause him to have to sell the condominium. The IRS allowed in that case. Key factors in that example, though the IRS didn't point it out, is remember, these events all occurred after the date he occupied and owned the residence, the rules that took place, at least the assignment to the canine unit took place at that point. Now let's consider the recent case that came down, and you may have seen this summarized in your tax services as IRS allows adoption as unforeseen circumstance for exclusion of sale of home gain. Well, it's a little more complicated than that. In letter ruling 2006-13009, the IRS had this fact pattern. An individual and the individual's spouse purchased a home. They had a three-bedroom home. They had three sons. The taxpayer and his spouse occupied one bedroom, and the three sons occupied the other two bedrooms. After they had moved into the house, they decided they wanted to adopt a foreign child. Now, it appears, though it's not obvious from the ruling, that either they wanted to adopt a girl specifically, that was a requirement, that was a limitation they imposed, or adopting a girl was their only option. It's not clear whether that was externally or imposed or whether that was their option only. We won't worry about that. That wasn't discussed by the IRS as an issue. They discovered they could only adopt a girl if they could provide her with a sizable separate bedroom under state law rules. So they had to be able to provide her with a room. Since they could not do that in their current residence, and I would presume that means that all three sons couldn't pile into one bedroom, would be a little crowded, they could not pass the home study part of the process. The home study part of the process took a look at their overall situation to show that they were suitable parents, would provide a suitable home, etc. Now, the state also informed them that once the home study began, there could be no changes in their circumstances. So it wasn't as if we could start the process, do the home study, and basically with the proviso that we'll replace the home and get the larger bedroom, you know, before the child comes in. No, the larger home had to be in place when they started the home study. Now, the taxpayer was in the military. This was also a complicating factor because he was scheduled to be transferred to a new post of duty at a point in the future. The ruling doesn't make it perfectly clear, but it appears that the time frames involved were such that if they held their current residence till the two-year periods expired and then sold it, that there would not be enough time from the sale of the current residence and no longer use of current residence as principal residence until the time that he was going to be reassigned for the home study to be completed. So the home study would be delayed all the way down until his reassignment, potentially under a new set of state rules and obviously, with different individuals that have to start the process over. They basically could not adopt this child they were looking to adopt. So it wasn't feasible to wait the period out. The taxpayer went ahead and rented a larger house and moved into that as their principal residence for the duration of the home study period. So basically, they got the house with an extra bedroom. They sold the original residence the day after they started occupying the rental property. Now, that's probably not terribly important in one sense because, as a practical matter, even had they not sold it, if they just held it till the 2 years are up, remember, they're not using it as a principal residence, so they're going to fail that 2-year test no matter what, even if they had held it out till the end. Before moving out of the residence, they had undertaken a number of steps to adopt the girl. In that fact pattern, the IRS allowed the unforeseen circumstance exception to apply. Now, what does this ruling mean? Well, as noted, a lot of you saw this summarized as adoption allowed as unforeseen circumstance. What it really means, though, is that this particular adoption was treated as meeting that test for this taxpayer. Remember, it was a private letter ruling. As is often the case, the exact facts here are crucial. Let's remember some of the key things that happened. the taxpayers demonstrated to the satisfaction of the IRS they had not made the decision to adopt or hadn't apparently even considered the adoption issue prior to occupying and purchasing the old residence. So it wasn't as if they were going to adopt this girl and, you know, they knew they were going to do that. They bought the residence and oops, after they bought the residence, they discovered there was this problem. Rather, they hadn't even thought about this. So it wasn't that they were derelict in looking over all of the rules that would apply to them, you know, when they did this, but rather they had purchased a residence. They had no thought at that point of adopting a child or apparently had not seriously considered the option. The IRS said at that point, then it was okay. Now they start the process. They discover this problem. That's fine. They also had taken substantial steps towards the adoption before selling. That's important because I believe the IRS is going to be concerned that you're not using this as a smokescreen. It's not an event being, it's not something that's been invented after the fact to explain why you sold this residence. They took these substantial steps prior to selling the residence. They were far enough along. This is serious. Clearly, this was the reason for the sale. Now, what that means is you cannot use this ruling to say that anybody that adopts a child is automatically going to qualify for the unforeseen circumstance exclusion. Don't go there. That's well overreading what you're seeing here. What it does say is, though, is that a circumstance like this, if you can take a look at the fact that we had not, that the situation arose after we occupied and purchased the residence, it was imposed from the outside, and it really honestly is the reason we're now selling this residence, you really have a shot at an unforeseen circumstance exclusion. Key issue here, the taxpayers were not in a position to wait out the time frame. In essence, factors really, really pushed them to say they couldn't do that. They had a number of factors. Were they crucial? Would the IRS have ruled differently had the taxpayer not been in the military? Would the IRS have ruled differently if there were some other issues or options? It's very possible. We don't know. But clearly, the outside circumstances that said you had to start the home study, nothing could change during the home study period, and we knew the taxpayer was likely to be reassigned at a date in the future. All of those combined to make it unreasonable to meet the 2-year period and then get things, you know, to hold on, stay in that house for the 2 years and still have the adoption move forward. Third key issue that I think is important for clients, note, this was a voluntary action. The taxpayers decided to adopt a child. That part, unlike some of the other things we looked at, did not get imposed on them by the outside. It wasn't something out of the control of one of the taxpayers. The taxpayers clearly made a decision, a personal decision, that resulted in the fact that in order to implement that personal decision, they had to change houses. What that means is maybe some options that could open up the options where other issues that might appear to be personal choice issues, where the taxpayers did something that was their personal choice that created an issue, may still qualify for this exception. You may want to look at carefully what exactly happened for taxpayers who sell within the 2-year period and consider that there may be more options open to the taxpayers to exclude that gain than you might have otherwise thought. The mere fact the taxpayer's own decision may be a crucial triggering event in causing the situation to come together may not be as important as when they made that decision. If there is evidence they were considering the issue prior to the purchase of the house, you have a problem. If it is clear that the decision and the issues did not arise until after they had purchased and occupied the residence, then you appear to have a reasonable argument under the regulations to get an unforeseen circumstance. Well, hopefully you've enjoyed your tax season, if you can enjoy tax seasons, and hopefully all your extensions are now filed or will shortly be filed if you're listening to this before midnight on the 17th. If you're listening to it after the 17th, you can all sit back, take a nice deep breath, and hopefully relax for a little while till you start working on those extended returns. Or, even better, start working on those nonprofits that have the May 15th deadline approaching for you now. That's coming up next. We'll be back hopefully next week, as after I recover from my tax season and hopefully get another tax update in play for you in the following week. So we'll take a look at what's going on. Enjoy your time. And hey, we've been through another tax season. This has been Tax Update for Saturday, April 15th, 2006.